Welcome to Innovation Calling,
the podcast where we connect the creators for the next big thing. We're your hosts, Aaron Smith
and Sia Yasotornra.
Hello and welcome to the Innovation Calling podcast. I'm Aaron Smith, and today's episode, we have a very special guest in Seejoy Olickle. He is of Plymouth AI, and Seejoy has a lengthy background with over 25 years of experience in management consulting, information technology, and global operations. He's transformed the processes and systems for the Global 100 while serving in senior leadership for a few companies you may have heard of, like PricewaterhouseCoopers, IBM, HP, SAP, Infosys, and Brinker International. He's spoken alongside industry thought leaders from leading technology and law firms for audiences in large universities and industry conferences. And Seejoy is also an adjunct professor over at the University of North Texas, which is one of the largest universities in the United States, where he teaches a master's levels course on blockchain. Now, what he does over at Plymouth AI, and he's going to describe this a little bit more in our podcast, is combine the data we're getting from blockchain with AI to help build smarter systems, make better decisions, all of that good stuff when it comes to AI. He's going to help C and I understand a few things around blockchain and AI. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Seejoy. All right, and welcome to this episode.
Seejoy, I have to ask, what does blockchain mean?
So let me start with a computer science type of definition, and then we'll build up from there and try to make it more palatable. Or let me start with something more palatable and then work backward.
First of all, welcome, Seejoy.
Thank you very much.
Was I supposed to welcome you? I'm sorry.
It's okay. All right, blockchain, sorry.
So blockchain, to everyone in the audience, is probably the greatest record-keeping system that humanity has ever invented.
Okay.
Now, a more technical definition of it is blockchain is a data construct. For those in the audience that know what a database is a database is a data construct. A file is a data construct, and blockchain is the latest iteration of computer science thinking about what storage of information looks like. Now, what's attractive about it is that in its implementation, these are designed to be what's called have a function or a property called immutability. Immutability means that once a record is written to a blockchain, that record stays there forever. Why that's interesting is it's almost a throwback to 5,000 years ago when we used clay tablets, where once you've etched something into a clay tablet, it's there permanently and no one can come along and make tamper with it. But if someone did try to tamper with it, then it's very obvious that a tampering effort was made.
So you'd like see a chip mark, a newer chip mark.
Okay. Mm-hmm, right. Now, if you had something like that, why it's useful is if you have a system or a process where you need to record something and ensure that a year from now, 10 years from now, 1,000 years from now, that information wasn't tampered with, then it becomes really important.
Right.
So what's the best use of something like that? Tracking money, mm-hmm. Which is why it was probably chosen as the data construct that powered Bitcoin. Bitcoin, I think most everyone can figure out for themselves, is probably the world's first viable cryptocurrency that's been adopted at scale globally. But it relies on a blockchain record-keeping system to keep track of who has what money at what point in time. And the way the network's implemented, it allows the blockchain network or the blockchain data itself to be protected by a network effect.
And it's, so basically mm-hmm. The data is distributed across multiple sites, so it's not one specific site for failure if there's a typhoon or something like that.
So right. So in normal databases or normal files, if let's say we were keeping records of our respective birthdays, and all three of us had our birthdays written on a piece of paper, and all three of us had a copy of it, and we kept it everywhere we went. If one of us lost that piece of paper, then we have at least one copy, and we can always make a copy and get up and running again. So that similar type of redundancy has been applied in the Bitcoin network, where everyone that puts a computer node up and starts to operate inside the Bitcoin network, they've all got a duplicate copy of the ledger, or everyone's got a copy of it, but they're all synchronized across the network. So we've always got a copy. So if there's 10,000 copies a day, even if all 10,000, but except for one copy still existed, then that copy could be copied all over again and start out right back up again. And you can ensure that it wasn't tampered with because you can go run basic hashing again, or run and check the hashes yourself and confirm that the information wasn't tampered with. So I paused when I said the word hashing, and I'll back up and just say, you can use mathematics to go look at that file that's a copy of the current state of the ledger and make sure that it hasn't been tampered with. Because you can rerun the same process and they created it and do it in reverse and figure out if someone had made a modification, and so that makes it reliable. So even if there was the end of the world happen, even if all the data in that blockchain is printed somewhere, you could still pick it up, put into some type of computing system, and start all over again.
That's crazy.
Like, no, it's so interesting.
It's absolutely fascinating to me. So if I were to say, okay, so I'm buying a Bitcoin, I guess. I don't even want to use a Bitcoin example. If I'm buying something and I'm going to send it over to Aaron, and it hits over these different points, if you will, what if I'm like some crazy hacker person midway through all these different points and like mess it up? Is it, I mean, that at that point, that data is corrupted on that line. Is the assumption being that because it's so mass distributed, it evens out and just ensures that one little corrupted portion of it is tossed out because it's some variable and everything else is consistent?
So let's talk about like what the system does at a low level, and we'll come back to maybe your example. So at a lower level, every node, which is a computer, so to speak, on the network, is going through an algorithm to ensure that things on that it's receiving are correct. So if it catches an error, it'll just reject it and go back and get another copy from someone else. Okay. So just like in the old days, we used to have what are called checksums on files just to make sure, hey, I've got the current copy, or I've got an uncorrupted copy that my download worked properly. There's a little checksum you could run to make sure that things worked. So in a similar vein, when you download a copy of the blockchain, you can go and validate those transactions yourself. And that's what the software is designed to go do. So it's somewhat automated for you in the background.
Okay.
But in your example, you're talking about if I'm sending value from one person to the next, it's a peer-to-peer transaction. So whoever is local to you gets a copy of that record, and they propagate that record throughout the network. And you're basically saying, I'm the sender, Aaron's the receiver, here's the value, and here's CS thumbprint. And once that's been approved, then that record gets moved around the whole network.
Okay.
So so there's a point in time where it could have been corrupted on the entry, or even if it was corrupted later, there are self-correcting mechanisms the whole way through.
Oh, it's crazy. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if that's the case, then blockchain is something attractive to businesses then. It should be, at least.
Absolutely. It's been running for, obviously the white paper was released about, the Bitcoin white paper was released about 10 years ago on Halloween. The software itself went public in January, a few months later. The platform's been running, and the data set has not been corrupted recently in a way that is not recoverable. Yeah, there were software implementation mistakes early on, but those were found and corrected, but the platform's been stable since then.
So this might be a stupid question, but when it comes to the tracking of the money, it only can be Bitcoin, right? So a business can't track these transactions with, it has to be via like a Bitcoin or a cryptocurrency. It has to be, correct.
So there's choices, right? Because blockchain, like a database, you can build applications on top of it. So yes. Bitcoin was an application that was built on top of blockchain plus a couple other pieces of technology, right? So the Bitcoin ledger or that blockchain decided that all the records in the system are going to be sender, receiver, value, and a signature of the sender to mm-hmm. ensure that the person sending it is who they say they are. That value could have been anything. That value could have been a Bitcoin, could have been a goat, could have been a cup of sugar. It could have been
a dollar.
It could have been the title to a house, a deed to a piece of property or a piece of land. So although the first implementation was Bitcoin as a cryptocurrency, that system could have been anything. So anything where you need to transfer a piece of information. Now, some people have written images to the network and things like that. That's, to me, is just pollution, but it proves that you can write, if you wanted to write information and keep it stored forever, then this is a great mechanism to do that. As long as there is enough people running that network, then you can keep on adding to it. Even if everybody ran away from a network and there's nobody processing anymore, it's still fixed in state and time. So 1,000 years from now, just like a time capsule, you could pick it up and look at the entire history of all the transactions that happened in that environment. So makes audit very, very easy to go do, right? So there's a lot of applicability. So if you wanted to transfer goats between people and chickens, you could use something like this if you wanted that if it was worth the effort to keep track of that kind of information. It's a great historical ledger, right? Because you've got no delete capability. So no one's going to come in and delete something that happened. So you've got an entire timeline of all the transactions that happened. And transaction doesn't necessarily be financial. It could be anything, right? Anything that you store in there. It's got a timestamp against it as well, too.
As I say, it's a timestamp with that data at that point in time. It's giving me flashbacks too when I was learning calculus of like as n approaches zero, whatever, where it is at that point in time, that's that timestamp. Mm-hmm. I know. In my head, it makes sense. I swear to God.
Well, it makes me freaked out, like how inaccurate is our data currently? I mean, with the ability to go back and wipe out stuff, with the ability to not track properly, I didn't realize it was a problem that so severely needed to be solved. But now looking back on it, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. For example, if you had a database, the database administrator, whoever has got control of that database, has the ability to, you know, create, read, update, delete, CRUD, as we say in the database world, right? Those functions are available, and you're trusting that the person who's got the keys to do update and delete doesn't go and whack your holdings. Whether it's the number of goats you have or the number of currency you have or what something of importance to you. If the network can only create and read up records, then you can always go back and make an entry that says, here's an update to my holdings, mm-hmm. right? It's like, I gave 3 goats a CA yesterday. So my total goat balance is where it is, because you can look at all my goat holdings from the beginning of time until today and then make out where I move goats around.
Right. So from a use case perspective, if I'm an auditor, auditing mm-hmm. company, then wouldn't this technology be like their best friend ever as far as like, ooh, it's going to make my life easier. If I'm going to go back to 2010, Aaron bought 6 goats from you. You can't fudge it and say, you sold 20 goats to Aaron back in 2010.
Right.
I mean, wouldn't that be
I'd have to go find my receipts.
Well, you wouldn't have to.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Network, I don't have to go dig up my receipts.
Woo! Hey.
So it's a great point. If you look at a forensic accounting, what they're trying to do is go back and recreate those records, and they have to trust they've got the right versions of the records and they all fit back together again and put that puzzle together and make sure someone hasn't created a new entry that was really to fake somebody out. And this thing, since you can't update a record or delete one, it's the entire life cycle that's being recorded. Every single event that you chose to record is being recorded. Now, if you chose not to record something, that could introduce some fraud. That's right. So one of the professors I teach with, she said there's a saying in Russia, fraud finds a way.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Anna. So respect to her for bringing that up, because as much as we think about trying to avoid using technology like this to minimize fraud, fraud will always find a way. There's always some opportunity there.
It's as long as there's humans. I mean, we are not an honest mechanism for, you know, being truthful all the time. Or no, for selfishness. I think it's greed, right?
Yeah.
So okay, fine. So what we just talked about there, that's more of the. It's already happened. Time has already happened to us. History's in the past. So what if we're looking at blockchain for the future? So. If I'm running a business, what can blockchain bring to me from maybe a predictive perspective? As in, you know, leveraging artificial intelligence, for example.
So from that perspective, it's a very interesting topic, and it's something obviously that we're exploring as well too, because AI systems that let's say predictive systems, they work well with lots of data. They work even better when the lots of data is reliable data. And if you've got, yep, Aaron got it.
Yeah.
It's like if you have a reliable system that has data for you for long periods of time, then you've got more information to feed into that system to figure out whatever it is you're looking for, whether it's predictive on when Sia will want to go get another cup of coffee, right? If we were tracking how many cups of coffee she had every day and is being written somewhere, then we can figure out her pattern. As much as we all think we're individuals, we are all creatures of habit, and just those habits are very predictable, or I shouldn't say predictable, but they're all very structured. And with that, there is some predictability to every one of our habits, right? We all live and work in the U.S., so a lot of us are pretty much out the door by 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. That's a very predictable pattern for a good chunk of people in the U.S. That may not be true everywhere else in the world, right?
Yeah.
And we're in Dallas, which means that we already know in our minds, if we get onto the highway at 8 a.m. in the morning, if we hit 635 in the tollway, we're going to be stuck there. That's a pattern that we've already picked up, but it's a pattern that we know because humans are really good at inferring a lot from a little. There's a whole diatribe on how we'd not get along with people just because one first impression is all it takes, right?
Yeah. One assumption can change everything.
Exactly. But in that sense, it's very interesting because many of these blockchains are putting data out there publicly, and what we're looking at is when we pull all that public knowledge together, what type of inferences can we make about people, about spend, and all those things that would be interesting to any type of business analysis, and what kind of products do we need to make because this is where people are spending their time or their money, and what can we do with it? So it becomes pretty useful. Now, before anyone freaks out that this is Big Brother looking over their shoulder, you have to also understand the governance side of it, right? The system has to define what it's going to write onto a record. It doesn't have to write that Sia gets a cup of coffee every day at 2 p.m. It just has to find a profile of a person of this category in this region gets a cup of coffee at 2 p.m. So that might be a good time to run ads for coffee because lots of our target demographic fit into that model.
Okay, so you're trying to you're trying to calm me down a little bit to say, look, yeah, your data of you being a coffee drinker at 2 p.m. might be in the system somewhere, but it's not maliciously looking at Sia drinking at coffee at 2 p.m. It's, look, you are probably representative of a good segment of the population. So by my data being inputted in, it's helping to create a profile, but not Sia profile per se. Is that we're trying to... comfort me with a little bit.
That's what I would hope that the people are doing. That's my recommendation because I'm obviously concerned with privacy and so on, but not everyone does it that way. If you look at what existing records and databases have on you, it's got your name next to it. It's got your social next to it.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. Date of birth.
Right. Everything
we all
is there,
know that. Right. But the 2 p.m. coffee thing, that freaks me out a little bit.
Yeah, it's on that note, what we haven't had as a society that's, our data has been harvested without our consent sometimes,
right?
Or without our knowledge and what it's being used for. Now we can argue about consent and knowledge and so on and so forth, but the one big thing that we've never been able to do is for anyone to be able to monetize their information to pay themselves. If you want information about me, maybe I'll be happy to share it if you compensate me in some way. If there's some benefit or some control that I can exert over that information, then great. Now, obviously, a lot of our personal information is already out in the wild. There's nothing we can do to get it back. But there are approaches, like one of the things that we're working on for next year, where we can actually have a marketing organization profile Sia and know that it's really a Sia. We'll protect Sia's identity on one side. Well, not we, but the system itself will protect Sia's identity on one side. But the knowledge of Sia's general profile being legitimate and Sia getting the opportunity to allow a coffee vendor to know what she likes, what time she likes it, her location preferences, et cetera, whatever is mutually beneficial to both Sia as well as the coffee
provider,
that they can share that information anonymously and Sia can be compensated for that as well too.
That's some crazy stuff. Is this Johan you're talking about?
Well, Johan is our first branded AI product from Plymouth AI. What Johan looks at is if I have incredibly good alignment between my marketing efforts, my sales efforts, and customer service efforts, then I'll probably be able to hunt the right customers, convert them, and then retain them, and then offer them the right products at the right place and right time, and know how to really service them. So the idea with Johan was that I've done this before inside of a large global organization, but we did it with about 300 PhDs in each of those domains. Not something that can be really replicated outside of a global 50. But if we can bring that to everybody, then companies in the US would probably really thrive because they're not wasting money on things that are not giving the right effort. Employees will be more satisfied that they're hitting their annual sales targets because they're calling on the right customers, not just looking at a list of 1,000 customers and not knowing which one to call on.
Oh, let me tell you, as a former salesperson, I can't tell you the insanity of giving a list of, okay, go ahead and here's your quota. And it's like, but there's no data. I don't know what I'm doing with these people. Yeah. Like,
right.
And then expect them to close a deal. It's mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a huge gap there, right? And that gap is something that, like I was saying, like 15 years ago, I could do this with the tools and the people I had available to me, but it wasn't something that we could scale out beyond that. Now that machine learning is in the last 5 years has become really available to those who know how to exploit it properly, I can actually start imitating what those people were doing manually by running inside of a machine. And that's why we created Johan as an outsourced human being or as an outsourced sales operations group. So you can hire Johan and they work right alongside with your sales department, your marketing department, and your customer service department. So each of them are advised on who they need to call. So it's just a pure prediction and recommendation about this customer is very likely to leave. And here's why you should call them. And that's not something that anyone's going to really know because usually you find out a customer's leaving after they've left. With enough data and enough time, we can actually look and say, these customers are likely to leave because similar customers have left. Or on the upside of it, look, they're buying from a new product category that they didn't buy from before. That means that there's some new project going on. Now, those are needles in haystacks, many, many haystacks that a normal department would never pick up on. And because you're not going to have a team working 24/7 tirelessly without asking for raises, but you can have an AI do that. That's where Johan comes in.
Wow, what a great business enabler that is. I mean, it's really creating efficiency for, again, your sales staff, especially because they're the one that have to go and hunt it down. But for your operations, too, right? That's mm-hmm. that's fascinating. That's all that artificial intelligence that we keep hearing about is, you know, how we execute on that. So,
well, I want to back up too because we're talking, and I know companies are utilizing blockchain, although it seems very buzzwordish, very mm-hmm. futuristic, all the things that it can do or will be able to do. But in order for you to run your company, you have to have the data to actually get smart and, you know, be predictive. So how is it being, I mean, who's utilizing it now and how exactly are they utilizing it? Because it has to be out there for you guys to actually create the AI or, you know.
Right. So from a blockchain side, I think quite honestly, we're one of the first people to try to use AI on blockchain platforms. We're using it in two directions. One is to ensure the blockchain platform is actually scalable. Because with blockchain systems, unlike traditional software systems, once you make a release of your product, there's no turning back. Mm. It's in the wild. It's going to be used. If you introduce a flaw, that flaw is there and it can get exploited. So when you hear about the hacks that have happened to blockchain-based systems like cryptocurrency environments, there is a flaw that wasn't found early enough and the product's released. And then once it's released, you can't roll it back. Unlike in regular cloud systems where you've got control over your server where the cloud software is running, you can issue a version update and move everybody to a new version. In a blockchain environment, in a public blockchain environment specifically, that software version is released and everybody can go to whatever version they like.
Wow.
So if I, you know, in my case, if I really wanted to go back to WordPerfect 6.2, I can go back and run that. I don't have to run the current version of Microsoft Word or Google Docs because the publisher has no capability on a public blockchain to delete that record. They can incentivize me to move to a new version, but that old version's still around.
And if there's a flaw in that old version, I can go in and...
and exploit it or use it to your benefit. Now, you know, some people have said, well, there's this feature I had in an older version of this software and I really loved it. Well, in a blockchain world, if it's a public blockchain and the governance says that once a version is released that it can't be removed, then you can feel free to go back and use it. Now, majority of people may have moved on to the new version, but you can continue to go access the old one, which is where it's important to get that software right before you release it. And that's not what people rush things to market. So then they fail on a good amount of testing. And quite frankly, unless you run like AI-based simulations, you probably won't get a right answer on if it's going to work or not. So that's one of the things that we've done this year is work a lot in that space on doing assurance on blockchain networks before they're released. Going forward, what we're looking at is now that the data is propagating into these blockchains, what can we clean out of these systems, right? Because no one's going to use a single database. No one's going to use a single blockchain. If you open up your phone right now, you're running 20 different databases already, right? So there's going to be blockchain projects all over the world doing different things for different purposes. What happens when you start reading all that information? What can we figure out from that? That's the area of research that we're in today. And we'll be probably releasing a study on that in early 2019. So hopefully we'll come back and chat about what we found.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm like, hurry up and get it done.
It's the more records that are in there, the faster it goes. The AI, those machines just allow us to jump through data a lot faster because it's not we can use machine learning instead of a group of people to go look at that information and grab insights out of it. You know, it can quickly figure out what people's preferences are or what habits are versus as a human, we got to make some assumptions and then try to prove them correct. This one, our approach is, or machine learning approach is you just look at the data and let the data tell you what's going on. The machine will figure out the algorithm, not you.
Right. Interesting.
So what's the biggest challenge with this, how you're applying AI to blockchain? Is it sheer amount of data? What are you seeing like roadblocks that's coming up your way?
Internally, there's no real roadblocks for us because if it's public information, we can go read it. It's the what we struggle with is getting people away from the idea that AI is going to take their jobs away or discover something that they don't want told about them. That information is already there. There's no way to stop it once it's publicly out there, right? I honestly don't see too many like businesses leaping this far ahead. I think, you know, us as an organization, Plymouth AI as an organization, we might be far ahead of the curve in a lot of areas because most of our time is spent in research and then we take that research and apply it and, you know, help our customers. And many times our customers are people that are releasing new products and we're building the deeper technology that goes inside of it. So however fast those people bring those products to market is however fast our research gets applied in the wild. To that end, the blockchain world itself, going back to that one, there's been some big projects out there. One of our good friends, Gurvinder, created a platform called Everledger, which is in Europe, and it's a platform that allows you to track if there is a blood diamond sitting on your hands. So they're able to track the provenance of that diamond from the mine all the way to the jeweler. And Everledger is a project that his full name is Gurvinder Ahluwalia. He's with Digital Twin Labs, one of the global leaders in applying blockchain in the industry. Luckily, he's based here in Dallas. He's a good friend and a collaborator of ours at Plymouth. And what that platform Everledger attempts to do is to make a record of that diamond the whole way through. So there's assurance on the provenance of that diamond. Think about everything else that you worry about child labor, all these other things. It's a great prototype for that going forward. So that's one of the more public uses of it. What's useful there is that their governance model held up over time. So if you What I mean by that is that if you think about any platform you try to deploy, if there's not an incentive for all the parties to participate, then that system just really doesn't get adoption passed. If there's no carrot and it's only a stick, then it doesn't really last for very long. So if you, you know, just to mirror back, if you're familiar with EDI, which was introduced by the UN, if my memory serves me correctly, if I got the history right, but General Motors in the 60s really pushed that their vendors are going to move to EDI and no longer send in email invoices and email purchase orders. Oh, sorry, not email, predates that. We're not going to mail documents anymore between each other. We're going to use electronic data interchange, which meant that it's a secure email type environment where a file gets transferred between party A to party B. Those are really expensive systems to stand up. But it forced everyone to adopt that, because if you wanted to play with GM, you had to do it. The reason I bring that up is if you fast forward to today, Walmart has done this recently where they're tracking lettuce. Again, I personally think it's there's a lot of effort to make that work, because now you got to have every lettuce producer out there put their information into it. And not every one of these people that are you trying to put on the network or necessarily even have the technical capability to do it. So there's a lot of endpoints that they'll have to work through. But the idea there is that if we put it on, if we have all this information captured along the way, then we can use that information to track a recall, if there's an E. coli outbreak, et cetera. I personally think it's a good showcase project, but does it add value? It does, but I think the value is bigger on the showcase side of it. You can showcase tracking provenance of food in an environment where it's publicly eligible for people. Now, I'll take it back and make a simpler one. In the course that I'm teaching at UNT, I've got master's students in there, and they're taking this research and trying to apply it into real-world examples, things that that they're demonstrating that they understand it well enough that they can go into a corporate world. And when a C-suite member says, does anybody here know anything about blockchain, that our students can raise their hand and say, actually, I do, and I understand blockchain in the context of business. And look, I'm actually able to lead a team. So just one of the teams, they decided to cover coffee as something that they wanted to track. Now, initially, they wanted to cover the entire supply chain of coffee to make sure that child labor was involved, et cetera. Massive effort. That's only something that the IBMs of the world can tackle. And a team of master's students is not going to be able to cover that in a 16-week course. So what we got them to do is to think about a smaller, more local version of that to showcase what you can actually do. And it sounds trivial, but what they did is they decided to go, I shouldn't say trivial, it sounds fun, but what they decided to do is go into a coffee store. That coffee store's value proposition to the customer was that when we roast, when we open a bag of coffee beans, that we use that entire bag within 5 days. And there's a sliding price on that, on the age of that coffee. So if it's a fresh bag that's opened up, let's say it's $10. If every day that it exists on the shelf, it goes down by $1. I'm making those numbers up. You get the point, right?
Yeah.
So the value is driven on freshness. So they looked at what's that process look like today and how is it recorded and communicated to the customer, and it's done on a chalkboard. Now, what that means is you have to rely on the person who holds the eraser and the chalk.
As being honest,
right? So they looked at that system and said, well, we could do this in a database, which is the next step up, or a Excel spreadsheet or a Google worksheet. But again, whoever's got the chalk and the eraser still has control. Mm-hmm. So if they wanted to lie to you, they could lie to you and you probably wouldn't know. They said, hey, this looks like a system or a process where an immutable record might be useful, because then if I certify that that my coffee is a certain age, it's on a record keeping system that I, as a consumer, can independently go look at and validate that, nope, they're not lying to me. Now, that's a lot of effort for a cup of coffee, but that scales, right? And it scales right back up to the Everledger version that Gurvinder did before, mm-hmm. Where it's the exact same thing. I want to know the history and the origin of what I'm purchasing, what I'm consuming, what I'm wearing, and make sure that it's not doing that. Nothing was involved here that I don't want to be a part of.
Is all blockchain public information, or can I choose to not make it
public versus make it public?
Great question. That's probably what confuses, you know, one of many things that confuses a lot of people is there's a choice about governance when you implement a system. Now, if you're using a system that's chosen its governance, like Bitcoin, Bitcoin's governance is public read and public write, and everybody can see the sender, the receiver, the value, and the signature, and that's public information because that's that was the governance model they went under. Even then, you could still anonymize yourself by not connecting your personal information to that address that's being used. If you do connect the two, then obviously you can trace back to this is an Aaron to see a transaction or vice versa. But if you didn't connect your private information to that record, then they wouldn't know. They would just know that you transferred a trillion Bitcoin, or actually a trillion Bitcoin don't exist, but if you transferred 100 Bitcoin between two people, that record would exist that party A sent to party B 100 Bitcoin at this point in time, and the signature's there, and it's a valid transaction. Thus, party B's wallet should go up by 100, and party A should go down by 100 accordingly. Mm-hmm. But that information at that level needs to be public for the network to kind of stay together. If you wanted to add privacy to things like that, then you can take those steps about just avoiding connecting your personal information to it. But even within the system, so that's, you know, Bitcoin is kind of like the first implementation of blockchain that is out in the wild that everybody sees. Newer systems that add more software layers to that, you can decide that I'm going to send part of this is going to be public and part of this is going to be private. So I can say, I do wish to publicly show a transfer of value between us two, but the value amount I don't want to show. Or okay. I can go as far as I don't want anybody to know that you and I exchanged something at all. And those are a new area of mathematics called zero knowledge proofs that allow us, even on a public network where the record keeping system is public, but the transactions inside of it are completely private.
So they say, okay, something happened here at this point between mm-hmm. Aaron and myself.
Right.
What it was, we don't know.
Right. So to try to explain the spooky mathematics behind it, I try to use this analogy, and hopefully it's fitting enough. But if I were to send a package to you via UPS, all we'd know is that a package was sent. What's inside the box is nobody's business. The network knows that a package was sent, and we can confirm that it was sent between the two parties. But what was sent is not there. Now, if we start obfuscating that even further, it doesn't even show that who sent who to what to who.
You just know something happened something at this happened. Point in time and date. Mm-hmm. Something got shipped somewhere. Mm-hmm. They don't know it's me or her.
They don't know who it is. So it okay. could be P.O. Box to P.O. Box, and that P.O. Box doesn't have anyone's name attached to it. Mm-hmm. It's good enough for the record-keeping system to know that something happened. But from an outside person looking in, they don't have any view into what happened or who the actors were or what the transaction was about, which to us in the U.S. sounds like, oh, that's bad. But
it sounds shady.
It sounds shady. But if you look at even some of our other countries that are, you know, allies of ours, they still crack down on people for sharing information or emailing each other. Or if you were to donate to a charity that somebody doesn't care for, or whatever it may be, then they can use that information to go back and grab somebody off the street. So there are good uses for privacy. You know, when PGP, pretty good privacy, was introduced years ago, it was considered blasphemy by some people that why would anyone want to protect their information? It's more of a, why would I not want to?
Right.
You know, I won't get on a soapbox about it, but really it's if that information's out there, maybe it's going to be used for good. Maybe it's going to be used for bad.
Right. Or used mm-hmm. against you, like that movie that I don't watch.
That yeah. one movie that has data used against people?
Yeah, yeah. Where they predict, well, I don't know. There's some movie where they like, it turned out, I don't know. You know, right. I think it was a Tom Cruise movie where they predict you're going to commit a crime.
The precognition?
Is that the one? Thing. Yeah, the precogs.
Minority Report, yeah.
Yeah, oh, is that what it is? Yeah, and then I think South Park did a spoof where there was like dolphins or whales like doing, they were all the precogs. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, you just made me drift there for a second.
Yeah, that's a fun one. But if you think about it, there are also cases where you do want to have some of that information out there. So a company, in order to build up, let's say, credit rating and the current model of credit rating, would want to show that inflows and outflows or whatever it is that drives a credit rating report. So there is value in some information being public. The, you know, the how much I've done in terms of sales this year is something good for public reporting. Who I've done those sales with is something that I would choose to keep private, right? But those records and those contracts we may want to put somewhere that it's immutable so that we can't come back and dispute what who's got the right version. The content of it we may want to protect. So all of it is comes back to the design. So even though the system itself will let you read what's there, we can also as actors in that system decide what we write out to the network. And there are more advanced blockchain implementations that allow you to that automatically do that privacy work as well too. So it's a, you know, just like anything else, it's a choice you have to make. Which platform am I going to use? What's my purpose in using it? What am I going to write to that network? I don't necessarily need to write everything. It's just what I want to write.
What do you want to write? Yeah, right. Yep.
Or do I even just write the fingerprints or the thumbprints of documents so that the documents can stay with me, but only the thumbprints are out there.
So this is really fascinating. So you mentioned UNT. So those of you, it's University of North Texas. You've created this course. Aren't you the author for this course?
When you say it that way, it sounds a lot more prestigious than the way I think about it. But yes, yeah. Yeah, wrote the curriculum, building the content, and we've got 40 students currently enrolled, which was triple what we expected.
Wow.
For a first time course with, you know, the UNT, they did a great job of marketing it. Dr. Donna Lohr, who's my professor who teaches with me, she did a great job of promoting it to students there. Dr. Kappelman, who's the director of the department, did great in terms of making sure there's budget to promote the course. So for a brand new course put together this year, I think we're the first in the country doing it from a business perspective, not just a pure technical or financial, but we're looking at it from how do we actually use this and enable businesses to take advantage of it or new businesses to show up on the scene that didn't use it, that couldn't exist before, but they can now because now we've got a record keeping system that also has payment capability, which is a huge difference. And that's one of the key themes I try to make in the course is that over 5,000 years, we've had record keeping systems, but we have two different roles in commerce. We've had a banker and a record keeper. The record keeper records what happened and the banker records the value of what happened. But if you look at how those two systems from 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia grew up, it grew up and became the value is going to be recorded onto currency, and that currency then gets recorded into a database somewhere. The purchase order or the record of what happened is recorded in a separate system, and those systems are run by different networks. So if, for example, if Sia goes out and buys her cup of coffee, she pulls out her Visa card. The store records the event of Sia buying the cup of coffee for $3. But then the Visa network is the one that actually helps transfer the value between the two. Now the store has got to pay Visa, you know, roughly like 30 cents plus 3% for that transaction. So the store, even though Visa's not involved, their job is to move the money around. Two different systems. When you jump across systems, what happens? You end up paying the piper somewhere, right? Mm-hmm. So in this new world, what Bitcoin introduced is a concept of programmable money. Now the event of that value transfer happens, but the money transfer can happen within the same physical technology and within milliseconds of each other. So wow. Now the value for that cup of coffee is not sitting there waiting for 30 days
right.
for it to be transferred into the merchant's hands. It's instantaneous. So you could walk up, pull out her Bitcoin wallet, transfer the appropriate amount of Satoshis over to the merchant. Merchant gets it instantaneously. Transaction's done. The network takes a small fee, but the network is a set of computers that are running anonymously out there, and they don't care about the value of the transfer. They're not taking a percentage of how much money you moved around.
Right.
Very, very different than existing systems. That changes a lot of things. You can start building things, automation stuff that you couldn't do today using current payment networks.
Yeah. That's Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. So I guess we are running out of time here. So to wrap this up then is, so Plymouth is your company. I like to call it the basis of Skynet. I mean, high performance AI processing.
Yes.
You guys do a lot of research, consulting. Obviously, you've got a product here with Johan, which I think is absolutely fascinating. So if you want to learn about that, it's plymouth.ai. To check it out. Your website is less than scintillating as far as a lot of it. You guys are don't need to advertise because what you're doing is so unique. You're already heads and tails like down busy, right? I mean,
Yeah, we have people just discover us off the website and we intentionally don't advertise just because we're trying to let the right things find us instead of trying to interject ourselves into the wrong things. And it's been fun. We've had some really exciting conversations about everything from real estate to personal time management to wealth management, and on into different domains that people are trying to solve, but they're looking for a technology partner to help them figure out what's possible, how to build it, how to roll it out. And it's something I've done for 25 years for the Fortune 100. And it's exciting to me to be back up again on emerging technology.